The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for October 28th, 2017. Brian and I just returned from Israel last night, and although we're tired, it's difficult to come down from the high that this trip induced. Over the next few weeks, we'll sort it all out and share much of the country, the people, and the experiences we had with you. This week, though, I have two fabulous guests. The two interviews were recorded before we left for our trip, and I think each of their voices conveys a fascinating story. First is Jill Yesko. She was a pro racer back in the 80s, competing with the likes of Inga Thompson and Rebecca Twigg. She went on to become a journalist and filmmaker, and her new documentary, Tainted Blood, has just been released for your viewing pleasure. The story delves into the 1984 U.S. Olympic team doping scandal. The games held in L.A. that year should have been all glory for our riders, yet scandal found its way into the team via blood transfusions. The film offers a wide cast of characters and a deep look into how these kinds of issues happen. After a break, you're going to get to meet Amy Dixon. Amy began losing her eyesight in her young adult years. Her job as a sommelier, which depended upon her taste and smell, became impossible to perform as a result of medication prescribed to help slow down the progress of her autoimmune disease. At the same time, medication put Amy's metabolism on a fast-track weight gain, and after ballooning up to over 170 pounds, finding out that the disease wasn't going to slow down after all, and needing to regain some of her former self, Amy decided it was time to take matters into her own hands. Today, she's an elite paratriathlete. She lives on her own with her guide dog, she's founded a camp for sight-impaired athletes, and she's way more. So let's first talk with Jill Yesko about her new documentary, Tainted Blood. Hello, Jill Yesko. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
My pleasure.
Well, I just watched your film, Tainted Blood, and see how and why some of the cheating became such a huge part of the sport of cycling. Tell us how you came to produce this film. What precipitated the idea for it? I mean, obviously, it's an interesting and fascinating topic.
So this idea has actually been percolating for a while. I was a competitive cyclist in the 1980s and was just coincidentally living in racing in Los Angeles in 1983 and 1984. So I had I really had a firsthand a bird's eye view of the run up to the Olympics. You know, they built the Olympic Velodrome, which unfortunately is now a soccer field, specifically for the LA Olympics. And teams came early. to practice on the velodrome. So we had the tremendous opportunity to watch basically the best of the best in the whole world, with the exception of the Russians and most of the Eastern European countries, competing in Los Angeles. Because of the boycott, it was expected that the United States would win an unprecedented number of medals. After all, you know, our biggest enemies and our biggest rivals weren't coming. So the pressure and the hype was absolutely out of control. And if any of the listeners have lived in, say, Atlanta or any other cities in the run-up to the Olympics, you'll absolutely understand what a hype fest it is. So I watched these athletes win medals. I celebrated with my fellow cyclists. And remember, this was pre-internet, so we were getting our news the old school way, through Velo News, and you'd wait every month for that paper copy of Velo News to come out. And several months later, when the quote-unquote scandal broke, I remember feeling incredibly let down. Like, how could this have happened? We had the best team. Why did we cheat? So this idea has been tucked away in my mind for years. I later on became a journalist. I was a contributing writer for a wonderful magazine called Women's Sports and Fitness.
I remember that magazine.
Wasn't it great? I mean, it was put out by the Women's Sports Foundation. Yeah, it was a wonderful venue for women athletes to share their stories and to learn about other women.
What happened to it?
You know, it was a victim of the decline of print journalism. So many magazines have gone out of business. I wrote also for Rodale, had a number of publications in its stable, including Fitness Swimmer, where I wrote the Olympic Splashback column, where I would interview former Olympians, and they would talk about like their greatest races or their greatest failures. It was fabulous.
Maybe it's time to revive these women's magazines. It's a good time.
I wish. Well, okay, listeners, we need some backers. Let's do this.
I would love to do that. That would be so much fun. All right, I guess we need to get back to Tainted Blood here, because the film is just riveting. I mean, once you start listening to these actors who are not actors, they are real players in the real world. You just can't stop watching it. So keep moving on. I'm sorry I didn't mean to interrupt, but I really wanted to know what happened to women's sports and fitness.
You know, there is actually an excellent website that I've just discovered called Excel, E-X-C-E-L-L-E. I think it's excel.com, which in some ways recapitulates women's sports and fitness. They've got some great columnists, but, you know, it's just not the same.
No,
anyway, retired from cycling, became a journalist and a reporter. Wanted to write this either as a book or a magazine article. Didn't happen. All the journalism jobs pretty much died out. I went on to work in PR, something I still do but don't really like. And then had a late onset of filmmaking and like, why don't I make a documentary? I had begun taking filmmaking classes and done some shorter pieces, and I thought, now's the time. I had been, you know, following the whole spin cycle of Lance Armstrong, and was very touched by Betsy Andreu and her courage. And I was also tremendously curious about what had happened to the women that I competed against in the 1980s. And, you know, Facebook and social media are sometimes your friend. It was relatively easy to find people and to get in touch with them. And so the movie happened.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the quote-unquote actors who aren't really actors. I'd like to start with Dave Prouty, because he's a big part of the film. Who is he and what was his role? Because I would think that the current generation of cyclists on the road, and even though I've been around the industry since the 80s, may or may not know this backstory, and he certainly is a huge part of it.
Oh, Dave is also one of my heroes. So Dave was the executive director of what was then called the United States Cycling Federation, the USCF. which is now USA Cycling. And Dave, David actually written a book after he retired about his experiences, in part dealing with this doping scandal. So I actually spent about 6 months just reading everything I could get my hands on, hard copy, scholarly journals, blog posts about doping, particularly in that era, to get myself up to speed, which is how I discovered Dave's book. And Dave is maybe 80 now. He's not on Facebook. It took some investigative work to track him down. And I live in Baltimore, and it turned out Dave was just outside of Washington, D.C., and had an old-school landline. So I called him up. And it took some convincing for Dave to tell his story, because this was a very painful episode for Dave. I mean, basically, he was the executive director under which this unfolded. And it took some convincing to get Dave to tell his story. But I really think that, like, the two Daves, Dave Prouty, Dave Grills, and certainly Inga Thompson, are the moral axes on which this story turns.
Interesting, because another character is somebody I actually know of, didn't know him well, but don't know him well. But he does sort of play both sides of the fence, and that is Mike Frazee. He was a board member of the U.S. Cycling at the time, USCF. He played a huge role. So let's talk a little bit about Mike. He's a character. He's like a New Yorker, right?
Oh, my God. I've known Mike since I started racing, because I'm from New Jersey. And I knew Mike. I knew his father, Vic. I'd been to their store in Bogota, New Jersey. They had Parasport and JBC, which was...
Parasport, that's right.
Yes, that was a very powerful team. You know, they wear all pink. I'm still friends with some of the gals who raced on that team. And when I got back in touch with Mike, who is not hard to find, Mike said, he goes, when I walked into his bed and breakfast in New York State, he goes, I remember you.
Right. In that accent, exactly.
Exactly. Oh, my God. God bless Mike. You know, I think that it was interesting to contrast what Dave Prouty said. And Dave, you know, Dave just struck me as being, getting back to him for a second, and I believe you can see this in the film, just exhausted by this whole episode, even though it happened 30-something years ago. You could tell it kind of like took a lot out of him. And I don't think that Dave had a reason to cover anything up. You know, he struck me as somebody who was honest and wanted to, after careful thought, wanted the record to be as clear as possible. And I spent, and I really want to emphasize this, as a journalist, it so pained me that the guys who blood doped would not consent to appear on camera.
It's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they said a lot of stuff to me off the record, some of them, and I've heard things off the record. But again, as a journalist, I need to tell both sides of the story. And it was, as far as storytelling, it was difficult to do when you only have 50% of the people going on the record.
Well, Mike actually did give another perspective. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jill Yesko. She is the producer and host of Tainted Blood, a new documentary about the 1984 Olympics and blood doping with the U.S. cycling team. Dave comes across as just being very pragmatic. This is the way it was. These were the hard decisions I had to make. And then Mike comes across going, you know, it just wasn't such a big deal. And I'm like, well, you know, Mike, this may have set the stage for what we now know is just, you know, insanity in the U.S. cycling world. So there is a character who is very, very important to this, who refused to be interviewed, which I found interesting. I thought he would take any chance, and that's Eddie B.
Oh, Eddie B. I reached out to Eddie B. And initially, Eddie B. consented to an interview.
Oh, okay.
He did. I want to be clear with that. And I was going out to interview him at his home in California. I had my ticket, and about less than a week before, I called him up just to go over some of the details. And he said, "You know, I can't do it. I have I signed an exclusivity contract with a woman who is writing my biography." And I said, "Eddie, what are you talking about? Couldn't have told me this before." And
really?
I reached her in California, tried to negotiate with her. I asked to see the contract to see if we could, you know, I'm trying to do my due diligence, and she just wouldn't give. I'm not going to dignify this with a name calling. She knows who she is. And then as I put the film together and I, with my editor, I actually took out many of the more incriminating things people had to say about Eddie because I felt that was really unfair. I called him up again and I said, "Eddie, I want to give you another chance to be in the film." And he said, I decline and I wish you best luck. And I said, "Okay, Eddie, thank you."
You know, we need to really clarify who Eddie was, where he came from, and what his role was, because it was pivotal. It was really, it looks like it all came from him in some way.
Well, I mean, I could not interview Ed Burke because Ed Burke is deceased.
Correct.
And I also did not want to burden Ed Burke's widow, you know, with this. I don't know how much she knew. But, I mean, Ed Burke was a big player. I remember reading his columns in Velo News. I have the documents that were supplied to me by Dave Prouty. Some of the correspondence that shows that Ed Burke had been key in suggesting the blood doping.
Oh, interesting.
The blood boosting,
right.
Okay. As they called it at the time. Yeah. You know, my film is not, you know, you're going to have to draw your own conclusions because obviously the film is showing the story from different people's perspectives. It's a Rashomon story. It would have been better to hear Eddie in there to affirm things or negate them, but they're not there. The same thing for the other team members who blood doped. Were they coerced? Whose idea was it? Did you feel that it helped you?
Right.
Mark Whitehead, again, who is also deceased, I was told by Gary Blockus and other people that were Mark Whitehead alive today, they felt that he would have no compunction going on camera and being very honest about how he felt and, you know, why he blood doped. But again, that's all speculation.
You know, there was some speculation in and of itself that blood doping was not illegal in certain ways, that by
Correct.
Taking your own blood, storing it, freezing it, and reintroducing it at that time especially was not illegal. It was that's not exactly what these athletes did. They would go take anybody's blood who it sort of matched theirs and then introduce it. So we're looking at an outside influence, not using your own stuff.
Yes, and hopefully this is made abundantly clear in the film that the blood doping at that time was not technically illegal. It was made illegal by the USCF and the USOC and then subsequently the IOC later after this was discovered. However, Eddie B. and Ed Burke brought this idea to the United States Cycling Federation. This is Dave Prouty's contention. And they took it, ran it up the flagpole to the officials at the USOC, United States Olympic Committee, who said, "May not be technically illegal, but we still don't want you to do it for various reasons."
Right.
And then it was done anyway. And that's a problem. That's a
Sure.
very big, very big problem.
Well, one of the things that listening carefully and hearing every word of this film, Mike Frazee, I think, mentioned that you could also train at high altitude and get similar results. And my question would be, instead of blood doping, why don't you send the team up to, you know, some mountain in Mexico and let them train if they're going to get that oxygenated blood and avoid the whole issue? Why wouldn't they have just done that?
Well, according to Mike, and this, I believe Mike on this, the team wasn't organized enough to do that. Again, I'm reading an excellent book about the Lance Armstrong issue by Reed Alfergotti.
Yeah, it's a great book.
A really fantastic, a book that I wish I had come across when I was putting the film together. And what strikes me is the tremendous amount of planning and organization that has to go into any kind of doping regimen, but particularly when you're dealing with blood doping. The blood has to be withdrawn at intervals, reinfused, kept on ice. And according to Mike, the team just didn't have their poop together enough to do that. Hence, the half-assed, hackneyed way it was carried out in the motel room in Carson, California, using other people's blood. And there is just never an excuse for doing that. This is a time, again, when we didn't screen for AIDS, but more to the point, that blood needs to be very carefully screened for any number of other pathogens, antigens, and that wasn't done. And that put the athlete's health at tremendous risk.
So, you know, the 1984 Olympic team had astounding results. However, not all of the people who medaled or podiumed, whichever way you want to put it, were doping. People right. like Nelson. Nelson Vales did not dope. Now, he was a sprinter, and they did say that sprinting mm-hmm. would not benefit by blood doping. But how were riders like Nelson Vales able to compete if other, I guess because the East Germans and the Russians weren't there, would he have had a problem, do you think, if they had been?
Nelson would not have been competing if the Russians or the East Germans had showed up, because we only were able to put two sprinters in there because of that. So it would have been Mark Gorski. Now,
right.
I'm
okay.
going to throw a whole big bomb in this. This was a huge undertaking for me as an independent producer and director to do. People have asked me, well, you only looked at the blood doping. Did you look at any other doping that might have been going on, like steroids, which were certainly in play at that time?
Right.
I'm just going to put it out there. I did not do that because I did not have the capacity to look into any other types of doping that may have been going on. So I'm just going to leave that as an open question, and I want to encourage any of your listeners who may have knowledge of this, if you want to discuss this confidentially, we'll provide contact information at the end of this interview.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you one speculative question, and then I'm going to ask you to how our listeners can actually see the film. Do you think that the 1984 Olympics were sort of a catalyst to an expanded cheating program with cycling in the U.S.? Do you think that's where it really began to expand?
I would say certainly this is the first time, to my knowledge, that U.S. Olympic cycling team had a quote-unquote doping protocol, as kind of like half-baked as it was. I had, again, because not everybody talked to me, my initial intention was to see if there was a link, a very, very strong connect the dots between this and Lance Armstrong. And there are certainly, and again, not naming names, but in the cycling community, you'll know, there are people who overlap between the 84 team and Lance Armstrong. And I will kind of just leave it at
okay.
that. I think that this is an important story that should not be overlooked. It stands on its own merit. And as I tell people at screenings, you know, all doping scandals are in some ways paradigmatic and kind of like resemble each other. You know, there is the doping, whatever it is, EPO, HGH, hormones, caffeine pills. There is some kind of cover-up. There is a mea culpa. There's everybody spinning it. There is a call to do better. And then the next doping scandal happens.
It's an interesting way of putting it. Very interesting. Well, Jill, I really appreciate you talking with me about the film Tainted Blood. Tell our listeners how they can either see a screening, learn more about it, watch it on Vimeo. How can people get to see it?
Sure. Well, first of all, visit the taintedbloodfilm.com website, and I have information about how you can arrange a screening in your hometown and upcoming screenings. The film is now streaming on Amazon So please rent it and reach out to me. We have a Tainted Blood Film Facebook page, which is probably the most, will have the most up-to-date information. And you can contact me through Facebook or through the website. I am looking forward to hearing from you. And thank you for supporting independent women documentary filmmakers.
Well, you know, independent filmmakers make the real films. the ROI is pretty low, as people probably could figure out. So what's your next project, Jill?
So my next project is another documentary about women athletes and their attitudes and struggles with their body images.
Ooh, boy, that's a good topic for this time in history, I would believe. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. We will post a link to the taintedbloodmovie.com on our Facebook page, and good luck with all of your other stuff. And if you figure out if you need another woman writer for your new women's magazine that you're going to eventually publish, don't forget me.
You're number one on the list all with
right.
a bullet.
Thanks so much,
thank
Jill.
You.
Have a great day.
All right.
All righty. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Jill Yesko joined me from her home to talk about the documentary Tainted Blood. For more information or to book a screening if you like, you can log on to taintedbloodfilm.com. Let's take a break, and then we're going to come back to speak with elite paratriathlete Amy Dixon. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Well, we are back. It's off to one of my favorite places, Encinitas, California, to speak with Amy Dixon. Hi, Amy. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks so much for joining me on the show this week.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's just awesome. I found out about you through a mutual friend, Eric Stobin from Wahoo. So I find all of my wonderful guests through people I know. It's just great to be able to figure that stuff out.
Yeah, Eric's a terrific guy, and I'm really glad he connected us.
Well, it's so interesting because people ask me all the time, well, how do you find the guests? I'm like, they find me somehow or another. We get in touch. You have so many facets to you. I'm not really sure where to start. But I think we should start with either your triathlon, your wine, your public speaking, your patient advocate. Maybe we should start with your sports since this is a cycling show. Paratriathlete.
Bikes and horses and dogs are my favorite things. So.
Oh, wait, I missed the horse part. I knew the dogs were there. Oh.
Former professional horse trainer before I lost my sight. So, yeah.
You mean like the horse whisperer?
I don't know if I whispered so much as yelled.
I actually had a friend who we used to call the horse whisperer. So let's talk about your paratriathlon. You are an elite athlete. How did you get into triathlon? And I'm not sure if we should start with the fact that you have lost your sight or not, but you can decide that.
Either one, you know, that was the losing my sight is actually what prompted me to go into athletics, which is kind of ironic. Not certain, that doesn't really sound logical.
Yeah, maybe.
A whole lot of sense, but I grew up on a horse farm, rode competitively from the time I was 5 years old, and also grew up on the local swim team and swam all through high school and into college. And same thing, I rode horses and I trained horses and had a team of students that I taught for about 20 years and competed from Maine to Florida with my horse. And so you know, I was a former athlete, and I have a rare autoimmune condition called uveitis, U-V-E-I-T-I-S. And what that is a fancy word of saying, it's an autoimmune eye condition. So every time I get exposed to a bacteria or a virus, I lose more of my peripheral vision. And so a normally sighted person has 180 degrees of peripheral vision from right to left and top to bottom. And for me, out of 180 degrees, I have 5 degrees left. So I have about 2% of usable vision in one eye. The other eye, I have almost no usable vision. So it started when I was 22 years old and started with strobing and flashing was the first symptoms of my disease. And it kind of like when you look at the sun and you look away and see spots in front of your eyes for a moment. And it would come and go intermittently. And I sort of ignored it, just thinking I was overtired. I was in pharmacy school at the University of Connecticut and working on my doctorate, and which is a 5-year PharmD program there at UConn. And I was waiting tables at night in order to pay for school and having a really difficult time seeing in a very dimly lit fine dining establishment that I worked at. And I started making mistakes where I would actually go to pour wine and miss the glass and things like that. And again, attributing it to being overtired, you know, which is a logical deduction considering I was working full time and going to school full time. And fast forward, I ended up getting sent to a doctor who diagnosed me with this disease and told me that I was going to be totally blind within a year. And at that point, there was only 50 patients in the United States that had this diagnosis, and no one had beaten the disease, and there was really no way of slowing it down or treating it. And fortunately, that proved to not be true. I found a specialist in New York City who actually discovered and named the disease, and he put me on a high dose course of steroids for a number of months. I gained a lot of weight, and but it put my disease into remission. And so he said, you know, maybe you'll be like this for the rest of your life. And I was still legal to drive, and I had a hard time seeing at night, so I had to stop working in the restaurant business at night. And I became certified as a sommelier, as a wine expert, and a wine steward in the restaurant while I was working there. I trained at the International Wine Center in New York City so that I could, you know, selfishly make more money and work less hours while in college. I could sell wine at the restaurant, and rather than work 5 nights a week in the restaurant, I could work 3 nights a week and make the same amount of money. So it was entirely a money decision at the time, because I really didn't have a huge interest in wine. I liked it and enjoyed it, and I happened to be very good at it, because in pharmacy school, you know, your job is about memorizing organic compounds, and I have a very good memory, and I'm very good at cataloging information in my brain. And so wine is really a wonderful three-dimensional experience where you're smelling, tasting, and seeing. And so for me, it was very easy for me to catalog and memorize all the attributes of the wines that I had tasted, and have a mental Rolodex, if you will, of all these thousands and thousands of wines. And so it was just a natural fit for me. So I started working in the wine business during the day, and I could no longer go to pharmacy school because they were convinced that I was going to lose the rest of my vision. So at that time, I started actually training horses full time, and doing that because I figured life was too short to not do something that you love. And so I was doing the wine thing, doing the horse thing. And then I lost most of my remaining vision about 10 years ago. Again, my disease came out of remission. I went on a high dose of steroids. I gained 70 pounds and went through chemotherapy and a lot of drugs that actually ended up causing a form of cancer from one of the drugs that I was on. And at that point, went through a variety of surgeries. I've had 19 surgeries over the past 4 years. And in order to lose the weight, I was really frustrated. And being a former swimmer back in high school, I couldn't figure out how, being newly blind, how I was going to be able to exercise and lose all this weight. And I really wanted to run because I figured it was the fastest way to lose weight, but I couldn't figure out how to do it safely with my 2% of usable vision. And so I knew that a pool was fairly safe and it was a controlled environment as long as I got into a quiet lane or a lane that was empty. And I knew exactly, you know, it was 17 strokes to get to the wall, and started swimming and lost a little bit of weight while swimming. Then got bored with that and wanted to lose the weight a little bit faster. So started doing some spin classes at my local YMCA, lost another 20 pounds, and then started to try to figure out how to run, I would take an elastic band and tie myself onto the treadmill so that I didn't fall off, and started running. So somebody said through social media, they saw that I was swimming, biking, and running, and offered to guide me for my first triathlon. And that was in June of 2013. And now I've gotten faster and leaner and worked really hard and had a great coach and got recognized by the U.S. Paratriathlon team. And I was on the national team last year for Team USA, and was ranked third in the world this past season. So it's been gone from never having done a triathlon in my life into 4 years ago, crossing the finish line for the first time at 190 pounds. And now I'm one of the top ranked triathletes in the world. It's kind of crazy. It's sort of surreal that this has all happened in such a short time and at 41 years of age.
Holy smokes, Amy Dixon. Let me remind our listeners, yeah, we are speaking with amazing Amy Dixon. She's 41 and she's already lived a 90-year life. I'm not sure how you did all this. That is amazing. Just amazing. So let's talk a moment about how a triathlon works for you so that people understand. You do have to swim, you do have to bike, you do have to run. Are you swimming in open water? Let's start with the swim.
Yes, actually, I just got done this morning swimming out here at Moonlight Beach in Encinitas. So I swim with a guide, and they're my eyes, so they're in charge of sighting the buoys and navigating the course. And again, I have a little bit of vision in my right eye, so I tend to have my guides swim on my right because I tend to be a right-sided breather. So I can sort of, and I have them wear a very bright cap so I can spot them, and just keep looking and looking and looking for their cap and try to stay on their hip. And the tether goes around my thigh, my right thigh and their left thigh, and it's 1 meter long, or actually 0.8 meters is the legal length. And so it's a stretchy sort of bungee cord material. So if I start to drift too far left, I'll feel it tug on me. And if I drift too far to the right, I'll start knocking elbows or hitting hands with my guides. So we sort of find our own rhythm and, get into a groove, and I try to stay on their hip because it's a good place to draft off of. And then, we pre-discuss the course before we do a race or we do open water swimming together. So she'll tell me, okay, it's 500 meters to the first buoy. And then we have a 45 degree right hand turn to go to the second buoy, and it's 200 yards to the next buoy. So we pre-discuss the course. So it's very difficult to communicate while swimming, but she'll pick her head up for a second and go, buoy, really loud. And so that means I need to turn right. And so she's pretty good at that. Or if we're trying to pass another swimmer and we're getting tangled up in other swimmers, she'll say, come right. And then, or she'll say, sprint, if we're trying to get around somebody.
Right.
So monosyllabic commands. And that's pretty much how we swim.
And then biking. So you get out of the water, you're still tethered. So you already have your guide, I take it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then are you riding a tandem?
I am.
Oh, okay. Well, that answers a lot of those questions. I ride a tandem.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's in charge of steering, braking, and shifting.
Right.
And then we have a timing chain that connects our two crank sets.
Right.
And so, I'm forced to do the same cadence she is. And ideally, you want to find somebody who's a stronger cyclist than you if you're
right,
a smart person.
Right.
While they can't necessarily drag you, they can certainly contribute a good 60-40, of the load. And so all of my guides are either former pros or some of the top age groupers in the country right now, which is great. So I've got some fast women on the front of my bike, a lot of whom have a mountain biking background. I raced with a woman last week. I did a World Cup in Florida, and she's the top off-road triathlete in the country right now for Xterra. And so she really knows how to handle a bike, because driving a carbon fiber custom racing tandem is like driving a high-performance tractor trailer.
Right, right, exactly. Whose bike is it? Who makes it?
It's mine.
No.
Calfee.
It is a Calfee.
Yeah,
so our favorite tandem was a Calfee, and we gave it up because it did everything we wanted, but only for things like go there, come back. So we like to go on paths and trails. Today we might build a different one, but yeah, we loved our Calfee tandem. Great, great ride. So running, I take it you are also tethered, and you just kind of run. You need to find somebody who runs as fast as you.
runs faster. You need to find somebody who's a good 10 to 15% faster, because they have to communicate verbally quite a bit on the run. Because
Got it.
The way my vision works is that anytime my heart rate goes above 160, which I'm a sprint distance athlete, so my heart rate's pegged above 170 the whole race, I lose all of my sight. So I'm totally blind when I'm running. And so I really need somebody to communicate everything that's going on. Okay, we've got a 90 degree right in 10 yards in 3, 2, 1, turn right. Because they're not allowed to touch me except for during certain technical parts of the course, like if we're going up onto a curb or down a curb,
right,
or it's really uneven ground or in and out of transition. So everything has to be communicated verbally. Cracks in the sidewalks that will trip me, potholes, where the other athletes are on the course. She's giving me heart rate data. She's giving me pace data. She's giving me speed on the bike, all those things. So I'm getting data thrown at me constantly. And she's a cheerleader too. You know, she's coaching me and working on form and trying to push me. And so she has to be, you know, if I run like 6:40 pace for my race, she's got to be able to run 6 minute pace pretty comfortably.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. You sound like you just have so much fun doing this stuff. Do
you? It's a blast.
Yeah, it is.
Because it's a team, you know, the ones, I always say that, you know, versus wheelchair athletes or amputee athletes that are on Team USA, I have a huge advantage of being a blind athlete because I have a built-in coach and cheerleader.
Right.
Who's probably one of my closest friends running, biking, and swimming next to me. And my success is their success. And so they are doing everything they can to motivate me and get the best performance out of me on the day.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about something else that you do. I mean, it's obvious that you're a great athlete and that you are very determined to get what you want out of whatever it is you do. Talk to us about the work you do as a patient advocate and what that means and what you might tell somebody who's facing some sort of a health setback.
One of the things that was really difficult to me is when I first got diagnosed and I was dealing with, you know, especially having a rare disease, you're dealing with a very high level of specialists. And to stereotype here, a lot of these guys at the highest level of medicine that are more research types rather than seeing patients necessarily, because, you know, they're working on cures for these diseases. They're in a lab working on clinical trials and things like that. Their bedside manners seem to be lacking.
You think? I've been aware of that. I've seen
that.
Yeah,
and their ability to connect with you as a patient and as a person and understanding how these treatments and how this lifestyle of living with a debilitating diagnosis really affects you and your whole life, your job, your marriage, your family life, your friends, just being able to get through a normal day is a challenge. And so I realized there was a big disconnect and there's a lot of information that, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's a business, you know, the medicine, and these doctors, especially with all the HMOs, you know, cutting fees that the doctors are earning, you know, it's a numbers game. They have to see so many patients in one day. So there's only so much information that they can get to you in the 10 minutes that they're, or if you get 10 minutes with them, or the information that the nurse gives you or the office staff. So you really have to go in there armed with a lot of information and questions in advance. And not everybody knows to do that and doesn't know what question to ask to begin with, you know, because, you know, especially if you're dealing with a diagnosis that's new to you or you've never heard of it or is particularly difficult to treat. So it's very intimidating. And as soon as people see people in a white coat, they tend to shut down. And they also tend to take those people's, the doctor's word is God. You know, they the white coat really intimidates them, and they don't think to question anything that a doctor says. Well, you know, at the end of the day, you're paying for the service, so they work for you. they're not necessarily in charge or driving the ship. You're driving the ship, and people really need to realize that. And so, one of the things when I was working in the wine industry, that was really an aha moment. My job was tasting, you know, 40, 50 wines a day, and meeting with winemakers and importers and selecting wines for a chain of stores that I was the buyer for in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And they started me on a new chemotherapy drug to to suppress my immune system to battle my disease. And he sent me home with the drug, and I started it the next day. And I had a big meeting with a French winemaker that had flew into town just to meet with me that week. And everything tasted like aluminum. And I couldn't taste a single thing. And I was mortified because, you know, here I am meeting with this really famous French winemaker that had taken, you know, a week, you know, time out of his month to fly over here from France to meet with me. And I couldn't taste a bloody thing. And it was really frustrating. So I actually had to sort of fake it through the meeting and have one of my colleagues, my coworkers, take notes on everything for me. And so the following week, I went back to the doctor and he says, well, how's your week going? I said, you know, great, except everything tastes like aluminum. And he goes, oh, yeah, it's a common side effect of this drug. And I said, do you know what I do for a living? And he goes, no. I said, I'm a wine expert. I said, this is my palate and my nose is my job. It's how I make a living. And I said, it's like me cutting off your hands as a surgeon. And he goes, oh, I never really thought of it that way. I said, yeah. So I said, you've taken my ability to make an income. And so you need to fix this. And so it was one of those moments where I realized shame on me for not mentioning to him what I do for a living and shame on him for not asking and realizing that the treatment that he was giving me was affecting my entire life and my job. And so I realized that there's a lot of patients out there that deal with, you know, for in my case, an eye disease, you know, that I know one woman who's an auto parts worker, factory worker, and she's worked there since she was out of high school and she was losing her vision. And she was terrified to tell her employer because she was afraid she was going to get kicked off of the assembly line because she didn't have the ability to see to do her job and didn't realize that there's other services and she qualifies to be moved to a more accessible job for her, maybe working with computers that have assistive technology and things like that. And I realize there's a lot of lack of education out there. And so ideally what I do is I started a support group on Facebook, and it started with 500 people, and now we have 16,000 members.
Wow.
Yeah. And so my concern was that there was a lot of misinformation out there. A lot of people Google things, a lot of people read things on the internet. And so just trying to filter some of the information and helping people have better tools when they walk into the doctor's office. And a lot of people who are uninsured or underinsured, to help them get the right treatment, get them access to medications, point them in the right direction as far as, you know, getting assistance from certain pharmaceutical companies offer free or low cost prescriptions if they qualify, but people don't even know to ask those questions. So, you know, when they get out of the doctor's office, I can sit down with them or, you know, via FaceTime or over the phone or via email and say, okay, tell me what, you know, what do they prescribe to you? Do you understand how to take the drops? And if the drops aren't affordable to you, do you know that you have other ways to get them? And when's your next follow-up appointment? How are you getting there? A lot of people who are visually impaired have no transportation to get to and from doctor's appointments. You know, I've been working with Angel Flights, which is an organization that flies patients with diseases around the country to see specialists because, you know, I have one woman that lives in Iowa in the middle of the Corn Belt, and it's, you know, 100 miles to the nearest eye specialist. So right. For her, you know, treatment is not really accessible. So, and she has a rare eye disease. So we flew her to Boston to go get treated. Things like that, but that's not affordable to her because makes, you know, $22,000 a year. So it's been really, you know, pardon the pun, eye-opening for me as a patient and as someone who's observing from outside and watching the obstacles that people have to deal with in battling disease. So I've made every mistake and I've learned a lot in dealing with my own disease over the last 19 years. So I'm happy to pay it forward and teach people how to navigate the system and how to have the best possible outcome for their disease.
Amy, what's the name of the Facebook page?
It's a glaucoma support group, so it's called Glaucoma Eyes.
Okay.
Yep.
Can we talk about something I really love?
Yeah.
Dogs. Tell me about your dog.
Oh, yeah. Actually, it's my guide dog's birthday today. He turned 5 today.
No kidding. Well, how auspicious.
We're going to go to the beach and celebrate. He's going to get a half a day off, I think.
That's nice. So what kind of dog is he? How long have you had him? And what kinds of things does he do for you?
Well, he's a German Shepherd guide dog. He's from a guide dog school. There's about 7 major guide dog schools around the United States. And he's from Fidelco Guide Dog Foundation. And they breed only German Shepherds at the school for the past 60 years. And they are not an American line. They are a true German working line. So they look a little bit different. They're a little leaner, smaller, and darker in color. And he is 5 years old today. He has been working for me for a little over 18 months, and he's been to 5 countries and on hundreds of flights, or like probably 120 flights, I would say, in the past year. So he's a very well-seasoned traveler, and he's got lots of frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, right.
And he is really fantastic as my eyes. Like, his job is to alert me to any change in elevation. So anything more than 2 inches of a lip in front of me, whether it's a curb up or down or a crack in a sidewalk, anything larger than 2 inches is his responsibility to alert me to it. So he stops and he looks at me and he waits. And then I ask him to go forward. And what's unique to guide dogs versus other types of service animals is something called intelligent disobedience. So when I get to an intersection, a busy, like we'll call it a four-way intersection that has got a traffic light, I have been trained with a mobility instructor before. I'm allowed to have a guide dog who teaches me how to listen for parallel versus perpendicular traffic. And so once I hear that the traffic is perpendicular to me, then I know that it's safe to cross. And so, but if I ask my dog to go forward is the command, if he stands on the curb and refuses to go forward, I'm allowed to ask one more time. And after the second time, he has the power of veto, which means that he will intelligently disobey the command that I have given him because he sees traffic coming that I'm not seeing or hearing. So that is what is unique to guide dogs, is that they have this built in what's called intelligent disobedience, where you give them a specific command and they won't go. Like if you're standing on a cliff, or if you're standing on a curb and there's traffic, or there's a tree branch hanging really low in front of you on a sidewalk that's at your eye level, then you're not seeing it, things like that. There's a hose across the middle of the sidewalk,
right,
or somebody dumped their trash can across the sidewalk on a busy Saturday morning, things like that. So he will stop and refuse to go near it. And then when I ask him to go forward, if I'm walking down the sidewalk and there's construction going on and I don't see the construction and I want to go, say, down this sidewalk 50 yards, he is trained. So I ask him to find the way. And when I say find the way, that means I need to go to that place. I need to go forward. He needs to find a way to get me to that same place. So what he'll do is he'll back up and reroute me, find the next intersection down that's not blocked, and take me across the street and down and then back to where I need to go. So he has GPS, basically.
He's that's trained pretty
to
cool.
Find the location that I need to go. So he knows how to find the grocery store. He knows how to find the pharmacy. He knows how to find the YMCA, the bus stop, the train station, and what else? And my house. Those are his basic routes that he knows.
Wow, what a great guy. What a great guy. Is he your first dog?
No, he's my second. My last dog retired after 7 years of service. And he lives with my mom.
Nice.
Actually, 6.5 years of service. So he retired. I had a yellow Labrador from a different school, from Guiding Eyes for the Blind. And he's a wonderful, sweet lab. And he's living out his golden years with my mom. And he's spoiled. He gets to swim every day and go hiking with my stepfather and hang out and just get fat and eat treats all day.
So we need to, unfortunately, wrap this up. I have 2 questions for you, and actually 3. I'm going to begin with the 2. Normally, I would ask you if you have any pets, but that's already been taken care of. So I'm going to start with, what's your favorite food?
Ooh, well, I live on a lot of sushi, and now that I'm out here in California, I eat poke bowls a lot.
Ah.
So, I love poke bowls, tuna poke bowls. And acai bowls, that's my other thing. That's my big post-training.
What is it?
Refueling thing. Acai, like the frozen acai berry.
Oh, yeah.
So I make myself an acai bowl with bananas and frozen acai and granola, and it's really good.
Yum. And then what kind of music do you prefer?
Ooh, I listen to everything. Anything that's got a good cadence. I have a really cool app on my phone that matches the cadence of my run to my playlist. So anything that's got a 95 RPM. So that's really great when I'm on the bike, when I'm riding the trainer indoors, or out running and stuff like that. But one thing I do want to mention before we wrap things up, one of the things that I'm most passionate about right now is that I started a camp for blind triathletes down here at the Olympic Training Center in Chula Vista. And so I run it every January. This year I have it January 16th to the 21st. I started it last year because one of the things that was frustrating to me as a blind athlete was that everybody's like, oh, great, you get to participate in triathlon. I'm like, no, I'm faster than most age groupers. And so, and, you know, just settling for the fact that these athletes were competing in triathlon and participating, I didn't feel was enough. I felt that we could produce a group of really fast, elite sprint, Olympic, half iron and full iron distance triathletes if we focused on the disability and how to get these guys stronger, faster, and safer while being guided. So I started this camp, and I'm actually looking for guides. If anybody is an experienced triathlete out there who's a good bike handler, I'm happy to teach them how to ride a tandem and would love to have them come out and help out at the camp. It would be great.
Wow, what a great invitation for somebody. That would be wonderful, or for a bunch of people.
Yeah.
So here's what we should do. Tell me how people can get in touch with you. Is it the best way through your website?
Yep. My website is www.amydixonusa.com. So it's AmyDixonUSA.com, or they can follow me on Facebook, Amy Dixon Blind Athlete, or Instagram and Twitter at No Sight, No Limits. And that's the name of my blind triathlon camp. It's called Camp No Sight, No Limits.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for talking with us. You are an inspiration to anybody who is listening, and probably everybody who meets you. Someday, I hope we get to meet up in person.
I would love that. That would be fantastic. Go for a bike ride.
Well, I need to be on the back of a tandem, too. I am not physically, I am not physically limited, other than the fact that my husband does it all. You know, he like shifts and brakes and steers, but I pedal really hard.
There you go. That's part of tandeming.
Thanks so much for talking with me. You have a great day. Continue with your great work. And we will post all this on our Facebook page.
Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye. As you heard, Amy is one tough hombre. For more information about her and her work, log on to amydixonusa.com. I hope you enjoyed the show this week. Next week, it's an in-depth interview with the one and only Peter Weigel. Until then, have a great week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.